From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. The youngest ever detainee held at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is back in the news. His name is Omar Khadr. Today he lives in Canada. That's where he was born. The CBC and other media outlets are reporting that the Canadian government will pay Khadr more than $10 million and apologize to him for his mistreatment at Guantanamo. David Cochran is a senior reporter at the CBC's Parliamentary Bureau. He's in Ottawa. David, remind us who Omar Khadr is.
Well, Omar Khadr was captured in Afghanistan in 2002 after a battle with coalition forces. He was just 15 years old, and his father was a strong al-Qaeda supporter and an al-Qaeda operative, and he took his son off to be a jihadist. You know, he used him as a messenger for al-Qaeda when he was in his early teenage years, and then brought him to Afghanistan, and he was involved in a firefight in 2002 with coalition forces, and he's confessed to throwing a grenade that killed a U.S. Army medic named Christopher Spear and blinded another U.S. soldier named Lane Morris in one eye. And that's how he ended up in Guantanamo Bay, for his role in that battle having been brought there to Afghanistan to fight for al-Qaeda by his father.
So at Guantanamo Bay, his lawyers entered a plea for him, a plea of not guilty.
Yes, but he eventually moved on and pleaded guilty over time to five war crimes, including killing Christopher Spear. And there's been some suggestion as it went on that this was coerced, and he suggested that he made this admission as his way out. He saw a guilty plea in Guantanamo as his only way to be repatriated to serve his sentence in a Canadian jail. And he's now since appealed those convictions, and that's working its way through the court process.
Okay, so how did we get to the point of now, where the Canadian government has decided to apologize to Omar Khadr, who's now 30 years old, and pay him more than $10 million?
Yeah, we still don't have official confirmation from the government on the apology and the settlement. We have it through leaks and through source work confirming that that would happen. But the bottom line here is that the Canadian government really didn't have much of a choice. I mean, the Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that Canadian agencies violated his rights through their participation in interrogations and how he was treated while he was at Guantanamo Bay. They interviewed him. They gave information to U.S. investigators. He was interviewed after extreme periods of sleep deprivation. And what the Supreme Court ruled in one of its findings said, the actions of Canadian officials offended, and this is a quote, the most basic Canadian standards about the treatment of detained youth suspects. So there is a wrongful imprisonment suit filed by Khadr and his lawyers. And also there's precedent here with another Canadian named Meher Arar, who is a Syrian Canadian who was a victim of extraordinary rendition by the United States when he was snatched at a U.S. airport and sent to Syria for torture and imprisonment. Canadian officials were found to be complicit in that in terms of their involvement with the U.S. agencies. And Arar was given an apology and a $10.5 million settlement after an inquiry. What's happening here with Omar Khadr really falls in line with that precedent.
And this all hinges on how Canadian officials treated Khadr when he was at Guantanamo Bay. I think it's easy for us to forget that there are officials from other countries who are doing interrogations at Guantanamo. Do we know to the extent that he might have been tortured, and if he was tortured at all?
Well, we have some sense of his mistreatment, certainly. I mean, he said that in 2008 that he had been threatened with rape and violence. He was wounded when he was taken to Guantanamo Bay, and his lawyers say he was denied medical care despite his battlefield injuries, though critics of Khadr would certainly dispute that claim. But he also spent significant periods of time in solitary confinement. And you have to remember, he was 15 years old when he was taken to Guantanamo Bay.
And that's the main issue here, is it not?
Yeah, the Canadian courts have ruled that he was a young offender, essentially, who was treated like an adult combatant. And this is part of the problem. And they say there was a failure by the Canadian government to intervene and make sure that his rights were protected. And one of the things we know that he was subjected to is what they call the frequent flyer program, where for weeks at a time, he was subjected to weeks of sleep deprivation, moved from one cell to another every 3 hours over a period of several weeks, and then interrogated at the end of that, questioned by Canadian officials. And this is where they say this was a very specific example where Omar Khadr's rights were violated.
So how are people reacting to this, including the family of the American soldier, Christopher Spear?
Yeah, this is a very divisive issue. I mean, Christopher Spear's widow, Tabitha Spear, and Lane Morris, who's the other soldier who was wounded, they have already filed a civil claim in U.S. court and have been awarded $134 million in damages. The issue for them is that that is not enforceable in Canada without an order from a Canadian court. So they've now taken action and filed a separate action here so that if Omar Khadr gets this $10.5 million, that they can get their hands on it. But politically, this has been a very explosive, divisive issue. You have groups like Amnesty International, members of the current Liberal government, they're arguing that, look, Khadr was in effect a child soldier coerced into an adult war. And no matter what he admitted to, the legal issue here isn't what Omar Khadr did or didn't do in Afghanistan in a gun battle. It's what Canada did in violating his rights. The Conservatives, who were the government throughout this period of time, for the most period of time of his incarceration, they're blasting the settlement, essentially saying that Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister, is making a terrorist rich. And they're calling for Khadr to willingly give the settlement to Christopher Spear's widow. They're trying to mobilize opposition to this, saying that, in effect, that Justin Trudeau is making Omar Khadr Canada's newest millionaire. This may be the most controversial money Justin Trudeau spends in his time as Prime Minister.
David Cochrane, senior reporter in the Parliamentary Bureau for the CBC. Nice to speak with you. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And big news in the automotive world this week. Volvo announced today that starting in 2019, it will phase out conventionally powered gas and diesel vehicles. All of its new models will be either hybrids or battery powered. It's a clear challenge to Tesla, the all-electric luxury manufacturer that plans to start production on a less expensive mass-market car this Friday. Michelle Krebs is a senior analyst for Auto Trader and director of automotive relations for Cox Automotive. Michelle, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Volvo's CEO said today that this plan marks the end of the solely combustion engine-powered car. Is that as historic as it sounds?
I would say that this is a very bold step for Volvo. I think we have to keep in mind they're a pretty small player on the global stage. And frankly, every automaker is moving generally in this direction at various paces. But this is a bold move for Volvo in announcing that it will be going to electric and hybrid solely by 2021.
Hybrid sales make up about 2% of the passenger car market in the U.S. Electric car sales have also grown, but still just a fraction of total sales. So why make the decision? What is Volvo thinking about why this is a good business decision?
Well, a couple things. First of all, Volvo, which is a Swedish-based company, is now owned by a Chinese company, Geely. And China has been really looking at its air pollution problems, and that they've been giving a lot of attention to electric cars. So I suspect there's going to be a big push there. And then in Europe, where Volvo also is a player, they need to find a replacement for diesel engines because they are in decline. So this is the direction they're going. And a lot of European cities also are focused on reducing air pollution.
It could be seen as a challenge to Tesla, which will have a big day of its own on Friday when it starts production of its Model 3, which apparently is more of a car for the people. What's the demand been like?
Well, the demand for the Tesla 3 has been significant. I forget how many hundreds of thousands of people plunked down a $1,000 deposit to get on the list to have one of these. The Tesla 3 is intended to be a much more mainstream vehicle in terms of price, more affordable for people, somewhere around that $35,000 range. I think it'll be a very interesting test for Tesla and the electric car market to see, are the masses really interested in electric vehicles? Because frankly, as you mentioned, the small percentages of sales, the consumer demand hasn't really been there. Mm. What we see is consumers say they want electric vehicles, but then they go buy gas-powered sport utilities.
Right, and Tesla has some problems. Its revenue has been way up, but it's still posting quarterly losses. And also, this week, it said that it was facing a serious battery shortage. So, it does have some challenges. How important is the Model 3 to its future?
The Model 3 is very important because it is a mainstream vehicle aimed at a much larger audience than Tesla has ever gone after. I don't know that it will help them profitability-wise. Tesla's got a significant challenge in that it's running through a lot of cash. It's generating revenue but not profits. So how sustainable that is over the long term, I'm not sure. But The Tesla 3 certainly is a milestone vehicle for Tesla.
Also, let's talk about the automotive industry in general. Sales are down, jobs are down, and this comes after what had been a relatively good few years in the industry. What's going on?
The auto industry is a cyclical industry, always has been, always will be, and we are coming off an unprecedented growth period. We had 7 years of year-over-year sales increase to 2016 when it was another record. So we're seeing a little bit of softening. We don't anticipate it being huge. This year we think sales will be off maybe 3% or so from before, but still a robust market. What is happening, though, is it's a divided market. Sport utility vehicles are hot, cars are not. And so what we're seeing is a buildup of inventory of traditional cars, and automakers are addressing that with big incentives and cutting back production, and that's where the job losses are. If you work in an SUV plant, you're probably in good shape. If you work at a plant that makes traditional cars, you probably will see some layoffs.
Michelle Krebs is a senior analyst for Auto Trader and director of automotive relations for Cox Automotive. Michelle, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The circus was the most popular form of entertainment in America 100 years ago, and the circus sideshow was a huge draw. People would save their pennies to come to see the bearded lady and the tall man and the conjoined twins. Author Beth Macy dug deep into the world of sideshows in her book True Vine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. It tells the story of George and Willie Muse, two boys who were pulled into the circus in 1899 and spent most of their lives as sideshow attractions. Earlier this year, the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus shut down, in part because of concerns over the welfare of elephants and other animal performers. In the days Macy wrote about, humans were the ones exploited.
Ringling Brothers, when they closed, cited animal rights activism as one of the reasons that made them not so successful anymore. But back long before we worried about people exploiting animals, I mean, they were exploiting people in the sideshow, and chief among them were African Americans, people with disabilities, people thought to be fodder for people's entertainment to look at.
Could you read a little bit from the book?
Sure.
And maybe set it up for us, Beth.
Okay. So in this section, I'm describing the way the trains would roll into town. They said that the circus was like a moving city at night. They would pack up at the end of a show, and then they would go on to the next venue. And when they would wake up, it would be dawn. And people would come out. People who couldn't afford a ticket for the circus, they were called the lot lice. They would set their alarms to be there at 6 in the morning when the circus would unload. Because if you couldn't afford a ticket, you could at least for free see all the acts as they were coming off the trains, like just dozens and dozens of train cars. So I'm trying to describe how the sideshow fit into this. I say, picture a single car, usually somewhere near the front of the train, full of human misfits, a bearded lady, a skeleton man, a conjoined twin complaining that she hadn't slept because her sister was tossing and turning all night. The freaks, people called them, in politically incorrect language that fit right in with other offensive circus lingo, which was fine by most of the freaks because, well, they had their own pride of calling, too. As the art photographer Diane Arbus once said of sideshow performers, quote, most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've passed their test in life. They're aristocrats.
There was a certain kind of act they were looking for, a certain kind of person. And you go into this saying that the circus operators wanted to make sure somebody wasn't totally pitiable, but that they had an obvious difference from the quote-unquote normal person, and that they could do something that was to be admired, some kind of talent.
They had to have a talent. They had to be different and unusual to look at, not something you would see just every day in your daily lives. They had to be not offensive. So the fat lady had to be curvaceous, but still really pretty in the face. And a family of dwarves that could also sing. That was the other thing they wanted. They wanted people to have a skill so that when you came into the sideshow tent, the lecturer would take you by every act and introduce them. Then they would either answer questions about their disability, or they would perform. So there was a man who could put like 38 little ping pong balls in his mouth. Somebody else could blow smoke out of his eyes. They would present their skill.
And the person giving the spiel, the lecturer, would also, I mean, make things up out of whole cloth about where people came from. And this is what I want you to talk about right now. The two people who were at the center of the story that you wrote, a sideshow act made up of two African-Americans, Willie and George Muse. They were from a place called Truvine in Virginia. They were in a family of sharecroppers. They were African-American, but they had another visible difference.
Right. They had albinism. And so that meant that they were legally blind at birth and they have very light skin, but otherwise they had African-American features. And what the circus did is they exaggerated their features. So they had them grow their hair out long and they put them into dreadlocks before anybody knew what dreadlocks were. So they sort of exploded. The dreadlocks were sort of gathered at the crown of their head and they sort of exploded like fireworks. And dressed them in really kind of exotic costumes that matched whatever name they were calling them by at the time. So their most common name was Eco and Ico, ambassadors from Mars, and they were said to have been discovered coming out of a wrecked spaceship in the Mojave Desert.
When in actuality it was several miles away on a farm that they may have been taken from or lured away from when they were working outside in the field, or the way other stories go, their mother may have actually contracted or leased them to the circus for a certain amount of time.
Initially, yes. And if that's the case, and it was never anything I could quite pin down, but there is some likelihood that perhaps she initially let them go. She was expecting them to be returned, and then we know that they were trafficked unpaid for a period of at least 13 years.
Unpaid?
Unpaid.
They didn't get any money. They could send no money home.
They were told their mother was dead and to quit asking to go home and to quit crying. And so when she finally files a lawsuit to get justice for her family after she gets them back, she's able to prove that they've been unpaid for a period of at least the last 7 years that they've been with Ringling Brothers at the time. So she wins a settlement.
And that is an amazing part of the story, just that this African-American woman who's exceedingly poor, didn't have a lot of resources, was able to get these two back. Hold that thought, because I want to get back to exactly what life was like for these participants in the sideshow. We say participants, but really they didn't have much choice at that point.
I don't think they were all pulled in against their will. The thing is about you never know whether to believe the accounts because there is so much tricksterism and fakery. And sometimes the sideshow bands were usually made up of African-American performers, many of them from New Orleans. And to pick up extra money, they would take side gigs pretending to be savages that had been discovered from an African country. And they called this is, I'm going to go get my Zulu ticket this summer, my side job, pretending to be somebody discovered in the wilds of Africa. One of the things that people in the sideshow would always say was that people were laughing at us in the audience, but we were laughing at them backstage because they were paying money to see us. So in almost every account that you read, and even from people who I talked to that were in sideshows, there was this pride of calling, too, that they made a pretty good living. They weren't institutionalized. And those who were treated with respect were kind of proud of the work that they did. And once the Muse brothers were able to be paid, they actually got to experience a lot that they might not have if they had stayed home in Roanoke, Virginia, where they lived in abject poverty, where their family lived in abject poverty.
It's one of the fascinating things about this whole story that eventually, you know, when George and Willie's mother was able to get them out of the circus, they lived in very cramped quarters. They at one point would work for money by singing in a window of a local drugstore. They were good musicians, right?
They were good musicians, but one gentleman who was still alive when I was reporting on this book, he no longer is, he said they looked really sad to him. And they actually realized they were more comfortable with the sideshow people than they were at home, especially once they knew their mother was alive and they could come home to visit her in the off season. And they were contributing to their family's economy.
And so they really did buy in at that point, and they liked having an audience.
You know, it's great to be good at something, and it makes you feel good to be good at what you do. And I think the music gave them just untold amounts of joy. At the end of his life, Willie lived to be 108. He was still singing the songs he had learned during the 19-teens, little pop songs from the 19-teens and 20s.
You know, it's so easy to be revolted by the very concept of a sideshow and the kind of exploitation that was built in. But as you discovered in the story of George and Willie Mews, it wasn't entirely bad for the people who were in it. But what transpired to make it unpopular, the sideshow unpopular, and kind of a mirror of what's happened with animal acts in the circus today?
Exactly. I mean, you're right. We're almost revolted to hear about such things today. So they retire in the early 1960s, and because of how their mother had advocated, they had basically a house bought and paid for in their names. And they end up retiring at the same time in history that we start caring about disability rights, and the sideshow slowly fades away. And so their careers very much mirror the last 50 years of the sideshow. I mean, it was kind of at its peak when they first got going, and then by the time they retire, it's going away.
I'd like to end with a piece of music that you were able to get from Willie Mews's great niece. Her name is Nancy Saunders.
Yes.
And she gave this to you and set it up for us.
Sure. So this is a song that George and Willie learned in the mid-teens when they were first on the road. It was a World War I anthem about missing home. And Willie used to say when he was sad at night, crying, missing his mother, they would sing this song and his brother would tell him, "Don't worry, I know she's alive. I know we're going to see her one day." And so at the end of his life, when he's 108 and he's totally blind by this point, he has a picture of his mother up next to his bed and he straightens it every night, even though he can no longer see it. And he's still singing the song that meant so much to him, that harken back to this idea that we will be okay and we will see our mother again. And so Nancy got him to record it around when he was about 102 or 3.
This is late 1990s.
Yeah, wow. He didn't die until 2001.
We'll play it now. Beth Macy, author of True Vine, thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, my Piccalilli, farewell, Oyster Square. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle. And it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
The European Union and Japan are on track to sign a massive free trade deal tomorrow, one day ahead of the G20 summit in Hamburg, Germany. The new trading bloc would rival the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, both in terms of scope and economic impact. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake, and she's on the line from New York. Maggie, let's start with the timing of this deal. It comes right before the G20. People are saying it's a statement to the world about the future of free trade.
Absolutely. And I think they're right about that. I mean, listen, this has been a long time in coming because trade deals are hard, but there definitely seems to be politics at play. You know, Japan had been spending the bulk of its energy negotiating the TPP. Remember that? The Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, when Trump pulled out of that, I think the pivot to Europe was natural and Japan very much looking for a trade win and alternative. And in the case of the EU, Brexit has made their situation a lot more uncertain. And so I think they want to see a win on the trade side and an argument that being part of the EU comes with benefits. So that the politics on both sides seem to be the catalyst that got them over their disagreements.
Do you think it's a statement to Donald Trump and his stance on protectionism?
I think it is. Whether it's going to matter or not is another story. I mean, you know, much is going to depend on how what kind of deals Donald Trump is able to negotiate. He could make them nervous that U.S. companies will be left out and be at a disadvantage because of this. But on the other hand, you know, we have an interesting story out at CNN Money today on the web that some of this aggressive rhetoric may be working. There's a report out that America's biggest trade partners have taken fewer protectionist measures against U.S. businesses so far because they're worried about retaliation. So this cuts both ways. Until we actually see the deals that the administration does, I don't think we'll know the answer.
This deal between the EU and Japan, what are some of the terms of it?
Well, they are basically looking to – every trade deal looks to reduce tariffs, right? That's the main point. The sticking point have been farming, so it'll be interesting to see what they're able to work out there. Both the EU and Japan notoriously very protective about their farming and agriculture industries, especially the EU that scalped deers before, and we haven't had the details of this one yet, so we're watching. But a lot of people also looking at cars. Some reports out say that we could see a 10% – eliminate a 10% duty that the EU imposes on Japanese car imports. Japanese will also remove some barriers that are facing EU cars. And a lot of people say this could really boost the luxury car market in particular because of the higher prices. They face some of the highest tariffs. So that'll be good for some of those European brands, BMW, et cetera. What does it mean for Cadillacs? And for me
exactly.
also.
Exactly. Yeah. What about those brands in the United States?
And the Buicks and Lincolns. Yeah. Some of the car companies have really been trying to revamp, right, reposition some of those older brands into the luxury segment. So what does it mean for them? Are they now at a disadvantage? That's what we're going to be watching very closely.
Also watching whether or not it's going to go into effect, because just because they signed this deal doesn't mean it's going to happen. Is that right? I mean, we've learned along the way that these can be tough to hammer out.
The devil's in the details right. when it comes to trade. Listen, we all hear trade and it's so boring, we sort of glaze over. It's incredibly important. Yeah. It's incredibly detailed, and there are so many vested interests in each country. I was mentioning farming, for example, that, and in fact, the EU did something like this with Canada, and I think dairy farmers in Belgium almost upset the whole deal. So the details are going to be important.
All right, we'll see. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Thank you, as always.
Thanks for having me.
For some 70 years, North Korea has been isolated, impoverished, and bellicose. It's been ruled by three generations of dictators who despise and fear the West. But the current leader, Kim Jong-un, has upped the ante. During the past year, Kim has launched more missiles than his father did during his 17-year reign. North Korea's nuclear threat was already high on the agenda for world leaders gathering this week in Europe. But yesterday's landmark launch of a missile that could potentially cross continents gave the issue even more urgency. The other countries with the most at stake in containing North Korea are South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia. As President Trump heads overseas now, he'll be looking for their help. Former U.S. Ambassador to South Korea, Kathleen Stevens, told us by Skype that depending on what Trump is proposing, he'll have an easier time with some countries than others.
I think President Trump will find strong allies in the mission of, if you like, containing North Korea and pressuring North Korea. Particularly, I think, from Japan and also South Korea. Both Japan and South Korea feel very much threatened by North Korea and by the path that it's on. Now, there may be some disagreement, as there has been in the past, about what the best approach to take is. So I think President Trump, if his agenda is to take stronger defensive measures against North Korea, I think he will find strong partners in Japan and also South Korea. And by defensive, I mean increased military deployments and technologies to try to slow and prevent its ability to use its growing nuclear and missile capabilities. But how each of these approaches, defensive, pressure through sanctions, and some kind of avenue to dialogue, how those are all kind of balanced out, I think is where the discussion has to take place. And I'm not sure where President Trump is on this either. You hear different things from different parts of his administration. Certainly there seems to be a recognition from President Trump at this point that the military options, while they always remain on the table, remain very, very unappetizing.
Do you think that China, even though it seems somewhat reluctant, or at least it says it's doing all it can, President Trump is suggesting it can do more, do you think it has used all the diplomatic tools that it has?
No. China provides North Korea with its oil, for example. It could stop sending oil to North Korea. That would have an immediate impact on the North Korean economy and obviously on its military readiness and options. It could basically close the border, which would create an economic crisis in North Korea.
So why would it be reluctant?
China takes a long view China fears instability in North Korea. It sees a scenario where there's a collapse of the regime, of the Kim regime in Pyongyang, that there could be great instability on the peninsula, sending many refugees, North Korean refugees, into China. And it also fears a scenario that might result in the unification of the Korean peninsula as part of an alliance with the United States. So I think they feel they've used the usable leverage they have, but they're not willing to use their entire influence, which is enormous, because the risk of that would be a regime collapse, and they see that it's not in their interest.
During this period of extreme tension now between the U.S. and North Korea, the U.S. is without an ambassador to South Korea, which seems like it could only be a deficit. Do you think it is?
Yes, I hope the Trump administration nominates a new ambassador quickly. I will say that my former colleagues from the Foreign Service are managing the embassy well, and we have a very good chargé d'affaires there. But yes, we need an ambassador.
You used to be in that role, of course. How might it affect matters if we did have one right now, even though, as you say, you're giving a tip of the hat to your colleagues who work there?
One, I think that it sends an important message to the Koreans themselves that this is a high priority for us, and they are puzzled that no ambassador has yet been nominated. But an ambassador goes as the president's representative and is therefore in a better position, particularly in a time of crisis, to reach out to all parts of the Korean establishment, as well as to the U.S. military in South Korea, which, of course, is led by a 4-star army general. He provides certainly some continuity and back to Washington.
Kathleen Stevens is former U.S. ambassador to South Korea. She's now a fellow at Stanford University. Very nice to speak with you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, in Texas, a high school that once had a reputation for gangs and dropouts is turning itself around with some ideas that are drawing national attention. One experiment is a new model for how the school hires teachers based on an interactive game. Laura Eisensee of Here and Now contributor Houston Public Media reports.
About a dozen would-be teachers head into the main office at Fur High School in Houston. Inside, Bertie Simmons welcomes them to something unusual.
And you'll never do it in other school because there's no other school in America doing this. Have any of you ever been to Escape the Room? Have you heard of it?
Yes.
Okay.
A few candidates nod. They recognize the name of an adventure game. Some companies in places like Sacramento have used escape rooms to test out prospects, but it's hard to find another school testing future teachers with them.
Well, we have an escape the interview, and what we're going to do is put all of you in the teacher's lounge, and there are some clues in there. We're going to lock the door, and you cannot get out until you solve the problems.
Oh, how nice.
With the help of $10 million from the education nonprofit XQ Institute, FUR is trying to create a new model for high school. That means more than traditional sit-down interviews to hire teachers for a non-traditional school. Q, escape the interview.
It's going to show us whether you can work as a team. It's going to show us whether you're creative. It's going to show us whether you persevere.
The candidates head to the teacher's lounge.
Good luck. Good luck.
Thank you, thank you.
You never see me again.
Inside, music plays. A smoke machine pumps fog into the room, and one applicant, Megan Stevenson, reads their first task. She quit law school to teach.
Collaborate to solve the challenge and find the master key to make your escape before the room is filled with deadly gas. Introduce ourselves and identify the strengths of everyone in the room.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Hold off on clue one.
Soon they tackle other challenges. First, a blindfolded beanbag toss. Then complicated puzzles. Brashan Cockrell takes the lead. He hopes to land an assistant principal spot.
Yeah, that's a match. That one's a match. That's a match for y'all. Okay, that's a match.
While this unfolds in the teacher's lounge, down the hall, the principal and five other educators gather around a conference room table. They watch on a live video feed and take notes. Here's consultant Paula Fenley.
I'm penciling her name in.
Well, that's nice, great.
Very impressive. Could we make her a teacher instead of a clerk? She looks like she has some really good skills.
Before they finish, let's pause and check with someone who studies how to hire talent.
I'm Jamie Belen. I'm the Assistant Dean for Career Services at the Bauer College of Business at UH.
That's the University of Houston. Belen says activities like Escape the Room are great for team building, but as a job interview, she has doubts.
When you're measuring people, the measurements that you do need to clearly relate to the actual competencies you're hiring for, because otherwise, if someone's not selected, you do run the risk of them coming back and saying, I wasn't fairly measured.
Belen says there are proven ways to measure someone's critical thinking, like case interviews. And she says schools especially need their hiring decisions to be almost foolproof.
Because it's a school, there's so much risk involved when you have young children, and these folks are serving in the place of the parent all day long, and you can't afford to take risks with that.
Back at Fur High School, the teacher applicants, who have all been state certified, finally crack the code and complete their task. Principal Bertie Simmons asks how it went.
What have you learned from this that you might bring to a new job?
This is Megan Stevenson again. She's the candidate we met earlier in the story.
I got so much better at figuring out what the issue was at hand when I started asking the people around me, what do you see, what do you see? And it was kind of pieces of what we all put together.
Another candidate, Kenya Pinkard, says she had no idea they'd be doing an Escape the Room.
What I learned is that I can actually take a step back and watch everybody utilize their strengths. And then if there's something that I can add in a moment, then, you know, step in and add.
Simmons tells the job seekers she'll follow up with more traditional interviews before making a final decision for the 6 open teacher positions at Fur High School. For Here and Now, I'm Laura Eisensee in Houston.
Writer Amy Ettinger loves ice cream, so much so that she actually tossed vegetables out of her freezer to make room for ice cream. She's no dilettante, though. Ettinger has deeply researched her favorite food from coast to coast, from old-fashioned soda fountains to high-tech labs. She shares that journey in her new book called Sweet Spot, An Ice Cream Binge Across America, and joins us from Berkeley. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you.
Just to give credentials to your madness, I'd like you to read a paragraph from the bottom of page 10 of your book. You have it there?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I live within walking distance of 3 high-end supermarkets that carry half a dozen artisanal brands and several locally made pints. I visit one of the shops at least daily, checking on the supply of my favorite flavors. I have also liked the local ice cream parlors on Facebook just to track their daily flavors on my newsfeed. One local creamery has 4 different scoop shops, but in a nod to Santa Cruz's laid-back style, has an online listing for flavors in just one of those shops. As a result, I must set aside 10 to 15 minutes after dinner on summer nights, just to call around and see which has the dark chocolate salted caramel.
You must. You just must do that.
I do.
So for you, as with for most of us, ice cream memories go back to childhood as a comfort food, a kind of go-to food when family dynamics got too tense. Do you still turn to it as a source of comfort, or would you call it something else now?
I do turn to it for a source of comfort. I write in the book that I got into a bit of trouble in Milwaukee.
Can you tell us a little bit about the story? What happened?
Sure, absolutely. So I went to Milwaukee to talk to the frozen custard makers there. Frozen custard is really a regional specialty. And while I was there, I was carjacked in the middle of the day in a very affluent area of Milwaukee. And it was the most violent moment that happened while I was reporting and researching this book.
Did you still go for the frozen custard?
So I did go after that happened. And then I have a recipe at the end of that chapter called I'll Never Go Back to Milwaukee. You know, the idea being that I'm just going to make it at home. But, you know, the other day I was looking at the COPS flavor forecast where they show the different special flavors at COPS frozen custard. And I thought, well, maybe I will go back.
So your travels and also your kind of academic studies have made you a bit of a scholar in terms of your exploration of ice cream, because you took a class at Penn State. What was that all about?
Penn State has one of the oldest ice cream making schools in the country. It goes back more than 150 years. And they have people there who are trained in the ins and outs of making ice cream. And folks who want to learn how to make ice cream, whether they're big corporations or small artisanal places, often go to Penn State. So I wanted to understand their backgrounds, what they had learned through the training, and to get a sense of what really goes into good ice cream.
One of the things I know you have learned learned along the way is that it's all about the base. So what is the base of a good quality ice cream?
Base is the milk, cream, sugar, and in most cases, eggs. Some places don't use eggs. There's a Philadelphia style that doesn't. But in most cases, it's the eggs. And it's what's mixed together and pasteurized to create the ice cream. Most places in this country really do rely on pre-packaged ice cream base because they have to.
Because they have to. Why?
There are very, very strict pasteurization laws in this country. So to get a pasteurizer, to get a permit for a pasteurizer is very complicated. And you're supposed to have what they call a clean room. It needs to be kind of separate from the rest of the facility when you're pasteurizing.
So by the way, eating a bad batch of ice cream can be kind of dangerous.
It can kill you.
It can kill you if it's bacteria infested?
Yes, and it has. And before there really were these pasteurization laws and people understood what they were doing, what they needed to do, there were a lot of cases of ice cream poisoning. And we still have that in the country, actually. Home chefs, unfortunately, don't always pasteurize their base the way they should.
So if you want to know if ice cream is really, really homemade and you go to, say, a farm stand or ice cream place around the corner, what do you have to do? Say, do you make your own base?
That's what I generally do. But you'll usually see a pasteurizer if it's there. Places are usually so proud of having it. They're so rare that they display it in a way where you're going to see it, or they'll have some kind of sign up, we pasteurize on site. But I would say 9 out of 10 times, no, more like 9.8 out of 10 times, you hear that, no, we buy our base prepackaged.
So if they do buy the base, they can still put their own signature on it in some way on the ice cream, right?
Absolutely. I can taste a difference in different ice cream shops who use the same base because they have different formulas for how they're doing their flavorings and what they're adding in, those nuts or the mix-ins. You can really have your own signature on something, even though it's coming from a prepackaged base.
Okay. Can I do a little lightning round at the end here, Amy?
Absolutely.
Okay. Cup or cone?
Cone.
Sugar or waffle?
Waffle.
Jimmy's or chocolate shots?
Chocolate shots.
Chocolate shots. Chocolate versus rainbow?
Chocolate.
And best ice cream ever in America, says you.
Hard to choose the best. Can I choose two?
Sure.
Or three? Okay. I love Leon's Frozen Custard in Milwaukee, Bassett's in Philadelphia, Kurt's in Seattle, and McConnell's in Santa Barbara.
Amy Ettinger's book is called Sweet Spot, An Ice Cream Binge Across America. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.